Hi everyone, we have a special announcement before we begin this week's episode. Have you ever wished that you could walk around a city and be given a private, intimate tour whispered into your ears in a sultry tone by a celebrity expert guide?
All the time. Yeah.
Well, that dream is now a reality if you're visiting London. Ooh. Because QI has teamed up with VoiceMap, a brilliant self-guided tour app to bring you the first quite interesting tours, packed full of our trademark unusual facts.
And narrated by none other than Mr. QI himself, Sir Stephen Fry.
Whoa. Yeah. You simply download the app from the Apple Store or Google Play, select your tour, stick your headphones in, and get walking.
It's really easy to use. You can put your phone away because VoiceMap monitors your location as you're on the move, and it plays audio to you automatically as you arrive at each location. So it's great. You don't need to check your phone the whole time.
You can do it whenever you like, and like start whenever, stop, have a drink, halfway through.
Do it at 3 a.m. if you're interested.
Creepy.
We've got good street lights here in London, so you know, you'll be able to see everything. We've put two London tours together so far, one of Westminster and one of the City and Bankside.
That's right. So whether you're a first-time visitor to London or a lifetime local, you can take directions from Stephen and see the city from a whole new perspective. For example, did you know that
London is home to over 8.4 million trees, covering 21% of the city? This means that by the UN's standards, it can officially be classified as a forest.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
I feel so healthy now.
Yeah. Or did you know that our most famous landmark, Big Ben,
keeps accurate time with the help of a handful of pre-decimal coins? A single penny balanced on the pendulum can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second.
Who uses cash these days?
Yeah, only our clocks.
Well, yeah, only our clocks. That's where it all is.
You might discover how
London's classic red phone boxes were actually based on a tomb.
Oh, they do look quite like a tomb, actually.
So, what's not to love? To get started, just visit qi.com/voicemap.
If you're not going to be in London anytime soon, you can still get involved. You can listen to the tours virtually, just like a podcast or audiobook.
But before you crack into that, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Lunchbox Envy.
Hey. This week on Lunchbox Envy, the ancient Egyptians used them to embalm their mummies.
The average McDonald's Big Mac is covered in 400 of them.
And according to Assyrian myth, the gods drank wine made from it before creating the earth.
It's sesame. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf Manu. Hello Manu.
Hello Jack.
And we're also joined this week by chef and food writer Helen Graham. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome, welcome. Let's open the podcast. Open sesame.
Open sesame.
Ha ha ha. We'll get to the etymology of that later.
Oh, yes, won't we? Will.
Yeah, yeah. But Helen, thank you for joining us. I think you kind of inspired the sesame subject this week, didn't you? Tell us a bit about yourself.
I am a chef and food writer based in London. I have spent 11 years working in restaurants across London before leaving a few years ago. I most recently was the executive chef of a restaurant called Babila.
It's one of my faves.
Which is a Middle Eastern vegetarian restaurant.
Is it called Bubala or Bubala? Or neither?
Bubala.
Bubala.
Bubala. It's Yiddish for like darling, sweetheart.
Okay.
It's what my grandma called me.
That's sweet.
Bubala.
Oh, that's such a lovely name.
It's all about kind of, it's totally vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I took my South African father-in-law, who is he's not your typical South African Afrikaner braai master, but he's definitely grown up in that cultural sphere where you don't see a meal as being complete unless there's some meat there.
Yeah,
and he was convinced. So
that's cool. Yeah. We when it opened back in 2019. None of the marketing, none of the PR was like, this is a vegetarian restaurant. It was just a new opening. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of people like coming and kind of not realizing what's vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And some people just looking at the menu and being like, what?
Oh, really?
No meat. Yeah. And storming out.
Really?
And then we started getting a trickle of messages mostly from men, but messages being like, so I'm coming with my mates on Tuesday. Is it all right if I bring a steak you cook it and I'll just have it with my food?
You should say yes, we'll do it for £300 each.
Oh, that's mad.
That is really, I think that's very rude, actually.
Yeah. I also once walked in, like, this was really back in the early days when there was very few vegetarian restaurants, so it being vegetarian was quite revolutionary. Mm-hmm. I walked in and I was like, oh, they must be on a date. And then I was like, but what's going on here? Under the table, this guy had some cooked chicken.
No way.
That he bought from the supermarket on his lap.
That's outrageous.
He went to the toilet. He was like, pooping down the chicken.
Wow. People can't help themselves.
People are outrageous.
So funny.
So weird. Also, when you get to the end of your meal and you stand up to leave and
what happened to the chicken?
I didn't stay long enough to watch that. But I would have
sat at the table behind just waiting. Where's the chicken going to go?
I also am the writer of Centrepiece.
Oh, beautiful. Which we've actually put as the centrepiece of our set today.
The book is kind of about solving a problem where you're hosting a vegetarian dinner party and you want like a vegetarian centerpiece. Yeah, and I feel like, you know, you have a dinner party and the easy thing is like, oh, I'll just have a whole chicken or a whole T-bone steak or whatever thing. And it's like, how do you create that moment without meat?
It's great. It's really filled a niche.
Do you have many sesame recipes in this book?
There's a lot of sesame recipes in the book. Well, I've just spent my career working my way through like a bunch of Middle Eastern restaurants.
Okay.
And so sesame has just featured very strongly through my entire chef career.
Yeah.
And I have made, you know, 10 metric tons of hummus.
Wow.
And tahini sauce. Mm-hmm. Sesame is something that I feel very passionately about, and it runs through the book in both like sweet and savory dishes.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's super versatile. Is there anything you can't do with sesame?
No.
Actually, has anyone made booze from sesame? That's something I've never seen.
Apparently in Assyria, they used to drink it.
That's true.
I guess you can ferment everything, and like most early foods, we talk about the earliest porridge sludge.
Oh yeah,
you can make booze out of that. You probably make booze out of sesame mush as well.
We should bring that back. What, I reckon that would sell booze in Hackney.
That sounds delicious.
Can you imagine Broadway Market
sesame mush booze?
Ooh.
I think work on marketing
logo right. All good. I am obsessed with sesame. Also, when you suggested this topic, Helen, I got so excited. I knew so little about the plant and how it grew. So the sesame plant is a fruit. It was domesticated in India about 5,500 years ago.
Oh, a long time ago.
A long, long time ago. And then they spread all across Asia, and there are some wild varieties that were traced back to East Africa. And in East Africa and African countries, the plant is most often called Benny.
Oh, yeah.
And then in Arabic, I think it's got my favourite name, which is Simsim, which is beautiful. In South Asian countries, it's called Gingelli, which is another beautiful name.
That is
nice. Then we have sesame. So it's a really prolific plant because it's super duper oily.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's the oiliest seed.
Yeah, I've got that right here. The oiliest of seeds. It's sort of 50% oil by weight, isn't it?
Yeah, it's mad.
It's crazy.
In English, the word sesame?
Yes.
So it comes from the late Babylonian and Assyrian Shawashamu. Or Shamash Shamu. And that literally means oil seed because this crazy high oil content.
Yes, it's a bit like the word for oil in ancient Greek was the same as the word for olive, wasn't it? Because they were like the synonymous oil. With it's the oily plant, one thing we make oil from.
Super oily. And today it's still called and is referred to as an oil seed in production because about 70% of all sesame seeds are used to make sesame oil.
No way.
Which is insane. It grows mostly around like India and Myanmar and Ethiopia. Sudan makes really good sesame as well. They're famous for it. Do we want to talk a bit about how the plant grows?
Can I just describe the plant?
Yes, please do.
I found this great article written in 2004. But it started off with a botanical description, and I wonder how many of these words you recognise. So, the sesame plant is an erect annual, has deeply basal leaves, sometimes five foliate with dentate margins. The campanulate flowers are each borne at a node, with a yellow gland, extra floral nectary at each side. The calyx is pale green, sometimes with a purplish tinge.
Oh, I love especially, a pale green calyx.
Especially at the lobes.
The lobes.
And okay. The corolla is pale mauve, the fruit is capsulate, and unusually, bicarpellate. Can you imagine?
Oh, wow. So for listeners at home that don't understand high botany.
Yeah, I've just described it, Manny. What do you mean?
So it's really beautiful. It's so it can grow up to about 5 foot tall. It has beautiful white flowers, and then when they mature, they kind of develop into these kind of like green pods that look a bit like a squashed bean.
Okay,
with
yeah.
like little tubules on the outside. And then if you cut them down the middle, the sesame seeds are kind of like stuck in rows to a central like pillar that goes through the fruit.
Like the inside of a chili.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful. So a single pod can contain about 100 sesame seeds. And it takes about 100 days for them to mature from like planting to harvest. And one of the really cool things is you can hear them rattle inside the little pod when they're mature. When the plant is mature, it's fully dried, and then the pod splits open and it basically spills its seeds all over the place, and the seeds can get stuck in the ground, which is great for the plant, but if you're farming sesame, makes it incredibly difficult to farm.
Yeah,
you don't
want
to be like rooting through the soil and sourcing through all of these sesame seeds. So the key is to catch them just when they're ripe but not popped.
Oh, got it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I read that about half a farmer's crop. This is back in the old days, because actually someone discovered a breed in 1943 and then they've slowly crossbred it with other varieties to sort of get rid of the shattering effect, because farmers were losing half their crops because they would all burst way before they're ready.
God, I wouldn't be able to sleep if I was a farmer. Like, that's so stressful.
It's a stressful profession. Oh, yeah. So this guy called Daryl George Langham discovered this mutation in 1943. It's an American researcher. And he made a non-shattering variety, which they called indehiscent, so not shattering. Completely revolutionized sesame farming, because now they don't have to pick them before they're ready to pop, because they can just like leave them to fully mature and then use like larger machines, because a lot of sesame around the world is still harvested by hand because of this shattering and because of this seed spreading. So it's a really labor-intensive process. What's really cool is I was trying to find where George Langham was from, and I kept finding his son, who's called Derald Ray. Has the same first name, Derald, but he's Derald Ray Langham, and he is also a world-renowned sesame researcher.
Okay.
So it runs in the family.
The sesame pod doesn't fall far from the tree. Okay, it's time for our first lunchbox, and this week that is Helen's. What have you brought us, Helen?
I've bought apple, tahini, cinnamon, and date syrup tureen.
Oh, you spoil us.
I cannot wait. It smells incredible.
Can you talk us through how you made it?
It's Bramley apples, and you peel them, and then you slice them really finely. Mm-hmm. And then you melt some butter, and you whisk in tahini, date syrup, and cinnamon. Then you kind of like toss it all together, and then just layer it in a thing. Loaf tin. And then you just cook it for an hour. And it's one of, I say, the easiest recipes in the book. And it's nice because the tahini kind of holds it all together. And it also creates these different textures. So like the middle of the tahini is kind of like soft and creamy, like a tahini. Tahini, soft tahini. And then the you can see like on the edges where it's caramelized and it's become really like craggly. And then that's where you get like the varying textures of tahini.
Does it have a name? Because I have to think like puddings used to be called Sussex Pond Pudding, or like croquembouche is really cool. Like, we should come up with a better name.
Whimsical name.
Helen's Pudding.
Helen's pudding. Sounds a bit...
No, that's true,
We don't want that.
I was thinking...
Sounds really...
Launched a thousand ships, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my mum used to say, when I was little, Helen Graham, the face that launched on a thousand ships.
Can we get your mum on the podcast? She sounds really good.
Is amazing.
Yeah, so the way that I use sesame the most in my cooking is tahini sauce.
Mm. Oh, I love it.
Which is ground sesame. It's
yes.
Actually, yeah, it's historically the byproduct of making sesame oil.
Okay.
But it's sesame seeds that have been hulled and then ground to a paste.
Lovely.
It tastes, is very creamy. It's very intense. It's kind of like quite peanut butter adjacent. So it was like, if you imagine peanut butter, but made of sesame.
Mm-hmm.
So
nice.
Yeah, it's really nutty. It's really intense. It's got a quite a like full mouth feel. It's kind of very...
Oh, yes, it sort of dries your mouth.
Oh, yeah, I use that paste in so much of my cooking. My cooking is kind of very Middle Eastern influenced. And I'm a tahini stan. I use it in a lot of my savoury cooking and my sweet cooking. And I just love its kind of creaminess, but it's also got like a slight bitterness.
Mm. Tahini stan sounds like Manny's perfect holiday destination.
I am booking my tickets now.
I'm coming.
I'm in England's crew for the World Cup.
Good.
And used mostly, would you say, in Middle Eastern cooking, I suppose?
Yeah, mostly Middle Eastern cooking.
Because I know it from hummus. I've made my own hummus in the past.
Yeah. It's a big component of hummus.
Nice.
And tahini sauce is delicious in its own right, where you basically mix 50-50 tahini and water slowly to form sauce, lemon juice and salt. But I use it kind of all sorts of ways. So I will mostly use it to pour over all these like vegetable dishes that I make. And there's also so many different ways that you can use it. Another dish I like to use is, it's called sinia.
Ooh,
yeah.
And it's basically kind of a Middle Eastern, imagine a Middle Eastern shepherd's pie, except instead of mashed potato, it's tahini sauce.
Ooh.
And you kind of like pour it over like whatever it is, your like your vegetables or your meat, and then you have this tahini sauce and you bake it. And it kind of becomes like this savory, crumbly, creamy. It's like a sesame flavored bechamel.
Wow. Oh. I love it.
Ooh.
Yeah, there's so many different things.
Great stuff. I'm inspired.
I know, I was going to say, I've never heard of that. And it sounds like my dream food. Like that and a crunchy bit of bread, I'm imagining.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Scooping up. Oh,
so
I love
good.
It.
In baking, I regularly use halva.
Mm.
It's tahini and honey.
Oh.
That's boiled together to a certain temperature, to what they call softball temperature.
Ooh.
And then set. And it once it's set, it becomes this like kind of like, it's basically like tahini fudge. It's got really crumbly texture.
Oh.
And then you can take that and put it in like cakes and brownies and whatever. And when it bakes, it kind of melts, but still has that like crumbly texture.
There's also, I don't know the name for it, but there's one that's like nearly like candy floss.
Oh, I love
what
that.
Is that called?
Halva floss.
Oh, it's so good. I don't know. We'll call it halva floss, but I think I've seen videos of them making it. It's these incredible strands of delicious tahini sugary thing. Oh, so good.
If we don't know the name, let's just call it Helen's Fluff.
This is getting worse and worse. Oh, wait, can we try some?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
this is so good.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just going to finish this cookie.
It's also like it's not overly sweet. So you can kind of have it with like whipped cream with a little bit of icing sugar for a really kind of like nice dessert. But sometimes I have it for breakfast with yogurt.
Oh, yes. And a few nuts. Oh.
Yeah. See what I mean about like the craggly.
Thank you so much for bringing it.
It tastes also quite like Jewish to me. There's it's got like strudel energy.
Yes, I was going to say strudel.
Yeah.
Really good. I think tahini is supposed to be quite good for you, is what I've been telling myself all these years. I think I would be dead if it weren't.
No, it is really good for you. It's got loads of calcium, magnesium, iron, vitamins B, and E.
I read that sesame seeds themselves have so many antioxidants that... basically, it stops itself from going rancid because antioxidants are things that prevent oxidation. Mm-hmm. It's really bad for making things degrade, like rust is oxidation. Mm-hmm. And so lots of things in our body, if they're exposed to oxygen, will degrade. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need antioxidants. Mm-hmm. And there are so many, and they're so powerful in sesame seeds themselves. Actually, the oil is almost spoil resistant. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does spoil, but it takes a lot longer than something like olive oil, mm-hmm, or sunflower oil.
I spoke to... do you know Al-Nakil tahini?
It's really good.
Only because you've extolled the virtues.
It's personally my favourite tahini. And when you suggested we were going to research Sesame Helen, I called up Al-Nakil and I got through to the son of the one of the co-founders.
No.
He's a really lovely man called Ricardo, and he explained how they make their tahini. And basically their tahini is made from sesame seeds that come from this really specific place in Sudan called Al-Gadarif, which is famous for its sesame production. And because of this antioxidant sesame property and the oiliness, like he says, you can't do it legally, but you could leave it for 10 years or more.
Wow.
And their tahini would be completely fine. It's become such a popular tahini, and they make an average of 20 tons a day. And during Ramadan, because it's a really popular Ramadan food.
Oh.
I think because people dip dates in it and stuff.
Nice.
Which I do as well. It's really, really good. They can make 33 tons a day. And he says he eats sesame paste or tahini, or tahina as well. I think that's the Arabic word for it. He eats it every day for breakfast.
And I remember you planning a tattoo of the Al-Nakil logo. Is that a false memory of you? Did you end up getting that made?
I was going to, and then I was given a t-shirt with the logo on instead. And that kind of quelled the desire to brand myself with the Al-Nakil logo.
Don't do that for free.
Get them
to pay you to have it on your skin. What would my brand be? Maybe Pirello olives.
Ooh, very fancy. How about you, Helen? What would you get?
You don't put a bumper sticker on a Ferrari.
Oh,
I love that.
No. I'd love to talk about how you can tell good tahini from bad tahini.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Bad tahini, it really grinds my gears.
Does it?
Mm. And it's ubiquitous in the supermarkets. And it is ruining your cooking.
Really?
It's ruining your cooking. Wow. It breaks my heart. But basically, bad tahini is where the oil has separated at the top of the jar. Mostly served in glass jars, and mm-hmm, you can see it. And you open the jar and it's basically impossible to stir it.
I found that.
And that comes from when it's mass produced far too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it splits in production.
Oh.
And that's why good tahini is fully emulsified. So you open your Al-Nakil,
mm-hmm,
or, have you tried the Belazoo one too?
That's phenomenal.
I've had the Belazoo one actually, yeah.
It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And you open it and it's perfectly emulsified. You don't have to do any stirring or shaking. But the problem is with those tahinis where the oil has split, you're then going to spoon that into whatever you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's already split, it's just going to cause your recipe not to work.
And also when you get to the bottom of the jar, there's no oil left. It's all just solid.
Yeah.
I do quite like the solid bits. I'm not going to lie. Because that's concentrated tahini. It's straight to the vein.
That's a top tip then.
Why is it that when you're making a sauce with tahini, so often when I'm adding a liquid to it, it splits or goes really clumpy? How do you fix that? How do you get that back from that kind of separation?
That will always, always happen with tahini.
Okay.
There's no way of getting around it. Tahini has this way of making you feel like you can't cook, that you've messed up a recipe. And I remember when I first started working at the Palomar, where we had to make, 4 kilos of tahini sauce, and I had a mixing bowl the size of my entire workspace, mm-hmm, and you're whisking it and it seizes.
Mm.
And I remember being oh my God, what am I going to do? Because you're under such pressure. But what I didn't realise is if you keep going and you keep whisking water, it comes back together.
Oh,
yes.
It will always come back together.
Oh, that's reassuring.
Yeah. So there's no real way of getting around it, mm-hmm, other than the sheer belief that it will all be okay.
Believe in your tahini.
But you can add ice cubes and that will kind of help. It's it's so oily that, it will seize when you add water.
Wow.
And by seize, you mean sort of almost solidify and sort of stop your spoon. There's a lot more friction.
Vomit.
Ooh, you know, like, yummy.
But yeah, it looks like really like regulated and lumpy.
It's not hot. So you just go through the vomit stage and you'll come out the other side.
Push through the vomit stage.
Like a night out.
What? It'll be riots, right? Yeah, so that's my mini guide to cooking tahini. And I encourage anyone that hasn't to grab a pot and get stuck in because it's the best.
Get experimenting.
Yeah. Spoon it straight into your mouth.
Yeah, Manny, you're sort of the anti-chef here.
You don't need to cook it. You can just inject it if you want to. That's also fine.
I actually have some tahini-related trauma.
Oh no.
Where my first chef job at the Palomar, tahini arrives in restaurants in these 20-kilo tubs. Ooh. So they're like... literally by that big.
Massive.
And they stored these tubs on the floor of the like storage room downstairs. Mm-hmm. I came in one day and I accidentally tipped it over.
Oh,
and the whole 20 kilos of tahini kind of like spilt over the entire floor.
No.
And the kitchen porter was like, don't worry, I'll mop it up. Oh. Obviously, when you add water to tahini, it makes tahini sauce. So he was like, you know, like chucking water on it, mopping, and it was doubling in size.
Oh,
and it was just like overtaking this storage room. And I was covered in tahini and like, oh, it was
Manny's
so
had a dream about this.
Sounds quite nice. Also, just tahini becoming more and more. I'm like, oh no, stop.
You'll just be like rolling around.
Off, like, oh no, I fell.
Oh,
okay, it's time for our second lunchbox, and this week that's mine. I have brought you guys some black sesame soup.
Ooh,
look at that. It looks very alien. Here are 3 spoons.
Thank you. I don't know whether I'm excited or not.
Yeah, it's funny. So it's very dark grey and a little bit gloopy. I'm serving it cold. They suggest you can either serve it cold, room temperature, or warm.
Oh my god, that's freezing.
Would you like yours? How would you like yours cooked, madam?
I always love my black gloop cold.
Yeah, it is quite black gloopy. I mean, basically, this is a dessert from China, and it's made with black sesame seeds, which are specifically grown and specifically not de-hulled.
Mm.
So they've still got their outer shells on. When you produce white sesame seeds, you de-hull them, and you take off an outer layer. But black sesame seeds are a slightly different variety of the same sesame plant, which has been bred to have extra melanin. And that
melanin is the stuff in our skin that when we tan,
yes,
makes us.
People have naturally different amounts of melanin, and people who've like grown up near the equator will have more naturally. And it comes from the Greek word black, mela.
Oh, right? I see. Wait, and is that the stuff that gives our hair?
Yeah. So if you've got dark hair, you've got more melanin than someone who's got blonde hair.
Okay.
And when we go grey, it's our hair losing its melanin. And that is where the slight myth of the idea that sesame seeds can make your hair darker and prevent your hair going grey.
Right.
So there is some science behind this, because sesame seeds do contain important nutrients such as copper, which is used by your body to create melanin.
Ooh.
But that's only really going to help you if you're going grey because you don't have enough copper.
Mm.
So if you're going grey from nutrient deficiency rather than like stress or aging, because everybody goes grey, then it might help you, but there's not much science behind it, really. It's a bit simplistic to just be like, well, this contains melanin, so if I consume it, then I will contain melanin.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have covered on the podcast before, if you eat loads of carotene, if you eat loads of carrots or oranges, you will turn yellow.
This is
so
true.
It's not impossible.
Did that really happen?
Yeah, yeah.
Legitimately did happen.
Yeah, we covered that. It's untested then. I suggest one of us consumes the whole of this big bowl. But yeah, it's served as a dessert. It contains toasted black sesame seeds, rice, and basically sugar, and then you just boil it up until it thickens. Ooh. And yeah, in Chinese medicinal use, it's said to treat constipation, dizziness, and tinnitus. Now, there's no word on whether you have to stick it in your ear or not, but you know, if you've got that ringing in your ears that doesn't go away,
eat some black sesame.
I mean, it's worth a try. It's worth a try. So, do you want to dive in?
Oh, yes, please.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh no, I've seen the grimaces on your faces, but like, can you confirm that it's actually not very nice?
I think I don't want to discredit an entire like genre of dessert and like national cuisine.
Oh well, don't, because I might have messed it up. Like, so I've never had it in a restaurant.
I
this might be completely wrong.
Want to try it again. I think, but maybe a different version of it. It's very different to how I was expecting.
I think my brain doesn't really know what to do with it.
It doesn't look like any other food, does it? It kind of looks like molten tarmac.
I think like the texture that you've gone for is like, has its own like landscape. You know, it's got like a... I feel like it maybe needs to be a bit more sweet. It's quite savoury.
Maybe
there's a world in which that could be delicious.
Well, I'm repainting my daughter's bedroom right now, so we can just use it for wall plaster.
Well, I was reading about the kind of goth food trend in 2017. You know, black foods became really popular. So kitchens were adding squid ink to those their dishes. And then like black sesame ice cream was really popular.
Yes, I think it just looks good on Instagram. Right?
But it's really interesting because we, I think as a species, are not kind of geared to want to eat black food.
Absolutely.
Because they signal like death and decay and rotting. So it's a weird... It's a weird trend to go for. I think it was that shock value.
Or burned.
It
does look like charcoal now, actually, thinking about it.
But then you can do so much, like, beautiful stuff with charred flavours and, like, kind of the really deep Maillard. So with a charcoaly bit, I get, which is really lovely.
Deep Maillard. That's deep. The phrase I'm going to use when I burn the chicken. It's
deep,
not burnt.
Deep.
It's just deep Maillard.
So you said this was used medicinally as well. So I was looking into some kind of ancient sesame medicine uses, ancient sesame cures. So it was really, really popular sesame in ancient Egypt, and they used to kind of embalm their mummies in them. And apparently because of this, like ancient remains of mummies actually don't smell that bad. Like apart from the fact they would have been basically desiccated, completely dried, like all of the perfumes and all of the sesame oil made them smell amazing. And they used to use it to treat asthma in ancient Egypt. And then there's this amazing excerpt from a Greek physician called Dioscorides.
Dioscorides has come up before.
Oh, has he?
I think so. Was it the sugar episode?
Oh, sick. So he writes about the kind of ancient Egyptian use of sesame and like how he feels about it. He's not completely convinced. So he said that, it's great for inflammations of the ears and eyes and griefs of the colon.
Griefs of the colon, another great euphemism. Give it 10 minutes, I've got griefs of the colon.
Wait, didn't this work, the soup work for constipation?
Well, that's according to the Chinese,
And then there was another kind of 15th century herbalist, Hortus Sanitatus, who was kind of working or like developing on this older Greek work. He said that, it's also good for like suppressing nausea. And when combined with this specific plant called hellebore, it gets rid of all of the black bile in your body. Because we know with the kind of medicine of the humours, you had different levels of phlegm.
That's one of the big four.
Yeah. And when you did that, apparently it could cure insanity, which is pretty useful. Yeah. But neither of these guys liked the way that sesame kind of lingers on your breath and gets stuck in your teeth. People have been complaining about sesame seeds in your teeth for a really, really long time. But what's funny is today, sesame oil is still used in Ayurvedic medicine as a way to clean teeth. So you can do something called oil pulling, which is basically just like swishing oil around your mouth for a really, really long time. And apparently it kind of works like flossing. And it has been proven to reduce gum inflammation and actually help clean your teeth. So if you ever have leftover sesame oil, you can just... For 15 minutes.
That's a great noise.
15 minutes.
It's a long time. It is a really long time.
Well, I read another piece of Ayurvedic medicine from 1500 years ago, which was a very detailed description of a rhinoplasty. So kind of basically surgery to fix the nose if it's like torn off or you know.
So annoying.
Yeah. But yeah, sesame oil was, you continually apply it to aid healing and probably to prevent infection, actually. Mm. And actually, I looked into the nose generally. Mm-hmm. There's a piece of cartilage in your nose called the sesamoid cartilage.
Ooh.
It's just here. I'm pointing to the, how can I describe this?
Kind of like if you were going to get a nose piercing.
Yes, that little... exactly. Yeah, that probably pierces the sesamoid cartilage.
Ooh.
But yeah, sesamoid is it means sesame-like. Mm. You've got a number of bones in your body that are sesamoid, right? And they're mostly tiny, which is why they're called sesamoids. But the biggest one and the most famous is found in your knee.
Ooh.
The patella.
Is that the kneecap?
Yes.
I see.
And there are loads of sesamoid bones in your feet, which is why dancers often suffer from sesamoiditis.
Ooh, that sounds cute and painful.
Okay, it's time for our third and final lunchbox, and this week that is Manu's.
I have brought another sesame medicine, but in a very nice form. So yesterday, by complete good luck, a very good friend of mine called Yasmin bought me some sesame mochi.
Oh, sweet.
So it have a little munch on these whilst I explain what it's doing in our bodies.
So explain what mochi are as well.
Okay, so mochi are a Japanese dessert or cake, and it's made from pounded rice flour, which is called mochi gome. And it's like, when I say pounded, it's pounded. Traditionally, it's like two guys with massive hammers and they're like pounding this cake from either side. And the result is this kind of really nice, chewy, squishy cake.
Right.
Anyway, so this is the mochi cake and it's covered in white and golden and some black sesame seeds.
Yeah, I can see. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Really good. I love mochi.
Do you?
What's
your favourite flavour?
I'd say black sesame.
Oh, really? Nice. I think this might have a black sesame filling in as well.
I think it might. Okay, I can't get one out.
No, delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty, but I'm also getting that same, this is unnatural instinct from seeing some black food, yeah.
This is so good.
Mm.
Wow. So, today I wanted to talk about the poo transit test. So, I'm going to assume that as much as we've chewed our mochi cake, I can feel them in my teeth now, there are some sesame seeds that we have not fully chewed.
Oh, yeah.
And we will have swallowed whole.
Can confirm.
So if you do this like to the nth degree, basically, if you eat at least 2 tablespoons of sesame seeds, white sesame seeds in particular,
okay,
and you don't chew them, you can do it, you can mix it with water and you swallow them, they can help you track how fast or how slow your bowel movements are. And this can tell you a lot about your digestive health.
Wow. So basically, so is this just the first part of a lunchbox and the other part is going to come in a day or two?
Weeks.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
So it's a really long time. So basically the way that the sesame seed is kind of composed, if you don't chew it really, really well and you don't mill it, your body doesn't break it down. Okay. It's very similar to corn.
Yeah, famous.
So if you swallow a
bunch... The poster child of being seen in your poo.
So if you swallow it whole and you've and the white sesame, you will just see them come out the other side completely intact. And there's a nutritionist and like gut specialist called Julie Bell who gives a really detailed breakdown of how to do this process. So she says, you buy sesame seeds... and you don't consume any sesame seeds for a week before you do this test because you don't want any confusion about where they're coming from. Mm. And then you put 2 tablespoons in a glass of water. You can consume them immediately. So you just swallow them whole, no chewing. You have to write down the date and time of consumption. So write down when you've done this. And then you just watch your poo until it comes out.
Watch
the other
it all day in case just, it moves.
Yeah. And then you can analyze your results with a consultant or healthcare provider to help you figure out what your digestive speed is doing. And ideally, you want it to be like not too fast and not too slow, because if it's too fast, you're probably not absorbing enough nutrients from your food.
Straight through.
If it's too slow, you're not going to be detoxifying your food
properly.
It's all gonna keep it's going to keep like accumulating, and that's not what you want.
It's kind of like poo sticks.
Like poo sticks.
Except the river is my bowel.
Also, the other reason I chose mochi for this test, I'm not going to make you actually watch your poo.
Do you want us to report back?
You can if you want to.
I get it.
I feel like we've eaten so much sesame today, it might actually work.
That's true.
But the other reason I chose mochi was because mochi itself has a very difficult role in digestion and just obstructing digestion in general.
No, really.
So... So, because it is so sticky, if you have trouble chewing, it might get stuck in your body. So in Japan, there are quite a lot of reports around New Year's, because mochi is like a big New Year celebration food, of older people who can't chew very well, just kind of swallowing these mochi cakes whole and then going to the doctors with like, oh, loads of abdominal pain. And they'll just find like big rice balls undigested in their stomach, causing blockages, which is not what you want. And then another really big health hazard with mochi around New Year's is choking, because they are so sticky.
Yeah.
So in 2015, there was a Tokyo medical equipment manufacturer called Shinai Industries that created a Hoover attachment to... So it was like a long tube, and you stick it on the end of your like standard household Hoover. So if anyone got mochi stuck in their throat during New Year's, you could just stick the tube down their throat, get it stuck to the mochi, and then suck it back up.
Wow.
I know.
It's traumatic.
I mean, it's better than dying on mochi.
Oh, yeah.
I think.
So I've never been to Japan. I'm imagining, like, in this country, we have defibrillators everywhere. Do they have
mochi
hoovers next to the defibrillators? You've got to know where your nearest mochi hoover is at all times.
I learned the other day, too, the hazards of chia seeds.
Oh, right.
If you eat a chia seed that hasn't properly hydrated, because they like absorb so much moisture, if they get stuck in your gut, they'll just kind of like, and you could die.
Oh my god.
You bloat to the, So
holy shit, I eat chia seeds every morning.
Are they properly
popped? No, they're completely dry. That's how I like them.
You haven't pooed in like 2 years.
What's pooing? I've forgotten.
Wow.
So could you feasibly try and kill someone with a chia seed mochi?
Ooh.
Yeah, if you stuffed it full of raw chia seeds.
And then it would sort of explode in their stomach. And suck them all, desiccate them from the inside.
Crime.
It's the perfect crime, but not now.
No, now we've told everyone.
Ruined it.
My plan is spoiled. You know what we haven't touched on? Sesame Street was named after Open Sesame.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
Yes.
So there's the phrase Open Sesame. It's like a spell you say to open up something with treasure inside, I guess.
Mm.
Did you discover where it's from?
Okay, so the phrase Open Sesame is most famously associated with the kind of Arab myth legend, big collection of stories called the 1001 Nights. Or Arabian Nights, if you're not from that part of the world. It's really hard to pin down. So we think that the phrase was inspired by the way that the sesame pod splits open.
Yeah.
It's very like open.
Revealing its treasure.
But it wasn't actually in the original version of the 1001 Nights. So that is a story of Ali Baba, who goes to a cave and he says this phrase to open the door. But that particular phrase doesn't appear until Antoine Galland's version, the French translation, which was like many, many, many hundreds of years after this.
Yeah, it was
first.
Like the first decade of the 1700s.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've no idea where it's from, but Sesame Street is from Open Sesame phrase, which is really nice.
Yeah, I saw one theory that it's that, you know, the Brothers Grimm, who wrote some of our fairy tales, like Red Riding Hood. They have a version of their tales where the protagonists ask a mountain to reveal its cave of treasure, similar to Alibaba. And they say Open Semsi, which is an old German word for mountain.
Oh.
Which feels a bit too close to be, I mean, it may well just be a coincidence. So kind of the earliest form of internet login, like two-factor authentication. We're sending a six-digit code to your mobile, Alibaba.
You think Open Sesame then would be one of the top passwords?
Yeah.
Surely.
Write in if your password is Open Sesame with your email address and your bank account and PIN. that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
So Helen, where can we find you on the interwebs?
On the interwebs. My URL is... you can find me helengraham.co.uk or on Instagram at Helen S. Graham, which people think is Helen's Graham, but it's actually...
There's more than one of you, yeah.
S is my middle name.
Do you have any parting recipes to recommend? Maybe from your new cookbook, which is called Centrepiece.
Yes.
And it's out now.
It's out now.
Available all good for shops?
Yes. Yeah, okay. I'd recommend... Well, there's a few tahini-based recipes in there. I would recommend that at all.
I would also recommend the apple thing. Oh, it's delicious. So good.
There's also roast carrots with a lime, peanut, maple, tahini, salsa matcha.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Made with harissa. And loads of kind of sesame-based delights.
Yeah, I was gifted this for my birthday this year, and it looks fantastic on my shelf, and the recipes are so... It's really easy to follow as well.
Great stuff. Mm. Thank you to our guest, Helen, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot and me, Jack Chambers, with special guest Helen Graham. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.